Chris Hedges, it's so great to have you on the show. I have to say that our audience has been hectoring us for months, if not longer, saying, why isn't Chris Hedges on the show? Why isn't Chris Hedges coming on? And I kept saying, it's not for lack of effort. We just haven't been able to align our schedules. And I'm so glad that finally we were able to do so. And I'm thrilled to have you on.
Well, thanks, Glenn. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. So I want to begin by, obviously, there's a lot of substantive issues about U.S. foreign policy and domestic politics that I want to talk to you about. But before I get to that, I want to talk about media and how media has changed and how it's enabled people like you to find an audience without being constrained by corporate media. Because if people were to ask me, who are the journalists who have become most influential in independent media, you're definitely one of the three or four people I would instantly say is among the top. And the irony of that is that when I first got to know you and know your work, you were not in independent media. You were in the very opposite, sort of the belly of the beast at the New York Times back in right after the immediate aftermath of 9/11. For those people who don't know the story, because I think it's such a revealing story about how corporate media works and how it worked back then, talk about the reasons why you're not any longer with the New York Times.
I would say there were two major reasons. I spent 7 years in the Middle East, much of that time covering Gaza. I was based in Cairo. The Jerusalem Bureau for the New York Times did not really cover Gaza. They made very little effort to cover Gaza. So I would be sent from Cairo and live in Gaza for weeks at a time. I was very frustrated with the way the New York Times covered Palestine. And the way they did it, which was different. I went on to cover the war in Yugoslavia, for instance, and it wasn't like this at all. So if I was reporting on, let's say, an airstrike on a refugee camp in Jabalia or somewhere else, they would pepper the article with, I may have been interviewing an eyewitness, but then immediately would be followed with a different account coming from the IDF out of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or somewhere. It had the effect of essentially neutralizing the story. By the end of the story, you could believe whatever you wanted to believe. And that was very difficult. Finally, in frustration, I used my vacation time to go to Gaza to write an article called A Gaza Diary, where I spent 10 days living in the refugee camp of Khan Yunis with a great cartoonist, Joe Sacco, who wrote Palestine footnotes in Gaza. And I said, I'm not going to interview any official. I'm not going to interview any PLO official. I'm not going to interview Hamas officials. I'm just going to write day by day what it's like in this refugee camp. And that was an eruption at the Times when it was printed. And I was told, although I'm an Arabic speaker, I think they only had two or three at the paper at the time, that I would never cover the Middle East again. So that was the first blow. The second blow was the call to invade Iraq. I had spent a lot of time in Iraq. I had not only had gone into Kuwait in the first Gulf War I was not embedded. I was what they called a unilateral, which meant that I wasn't a part of any military pool, but I had grafted onto a Marine Corps unit, gone into Kuwait with them, and then stayed on in the Middle East for the New York Times, covering the destruction of the stockpiles, and Saddam Hussein had stockpiles of chemical weapons, mostly in artillery shells. So I covered all of that. I knew he might have had a tiny residue, but I knew he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I knew it was a lie. I knew the whole premise of invading Iraq, which of course had nothing to do with 9/11, was the fiasco it became, certainly up until Gaza, the greatest war crime. I mean, you have to go back to Vietnam or something. And I couldn't keep quiet about that. So I spoke very publicly on big media programs, and that angered the New York Times, especially after I was booed off of a commencement stage. And I was given a formal written reprimand from the paper. Though under guild rules, you get the reprimand in writing. I was called into the office of an assistant managing editor, Bill Schmidt, and given the reprimand, presented with the reprimand. And then if I violated that reprimand, i.e. I continued to speak about the war, then I, under guild rules, could be fired. And that's, I wasn't going to stop speaking about the war. And that ended my career at the New York Times.
The debate that is just eternal that people on the left and right have is over the bias of the New York Times. What is the ideological posture of the New York Times? Conservatives eternally insist that it's some left liberal bias or whatever. And then you have people on the left or even liberals who insist that it has this kind of institutional conservative bias. And, you know, for me, I've always thought that the ideology of the New York Times is kind of allegiance to the foreign policy community, the U.S. security state, and you, it's hard to, especially these days, place that on the left or the right. But I'm wondering, and I think there's a lot of people who haven't lived through that history of 9/11, post-9/11, the Iraq War, or people who just did but decided to forget about it. But in those instances where the New York Times was diluting your stories, basically negating the things you were reporting with IDF statements, giving them equal weight, and then especially with this idea that you somehow couldn't speak out against the Iraq War, even though many, many New York Times journalists were free to speak out in favor of it and were absolutely doing that, would you say that the reason was that the Sulzberger family or the New York Times just institutionally has this ideological bias, say, in favor of Israel, in favor of wars? Or was it more just the kind of post 9/11 uber jingoism that prevailed where, you know, pretty much a lot of people, I would say the majority of people in corporate media decided that their patriotic duty was to align with the war on terror or post 9/11 policies of the U.S. government?
I would say it's both. The New York Times, think of the New York Times as a, the ideology of the New York Times as being Cold War liberalism, which is different from traditional liberalism, which used to be, if you go back to Henry Wallace or maybe the last figure being George McGovern, was confronted the military establishment and military adventurism and the arms industry and it's they're always a cheerleader for war, whatever war it is. Of course, as you know, after 9/11, entire country drank that very dark elixir of nationalism and revenge, so that my outspokenness against the war led to repeated death threats. I would come into my desk at the New York Times, and the message bank on the phone completely full of death threats. And the only reason there weren't more is because they ran out of space. I also got written death threats, bomb threats, all this kind of stuff. So you know as very well that that was a very difficult time to speak out against the war. I just want to say that if this wasn't an opinion, I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I had detailed knowledge of what had happened in the aftermath of the first Gulf War in Iraq. I understood that Iraq was not only no longer a threat to its neighbors, it certainly wasn't a threat to us. I had covered 9/11 and knew that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. So all of this essentially, you know, these kinds of fact-based statements became an anathema. I would also say that my colleagues who cover the Middle East, their opinion was no different from mine, but they were careerists. And I think many, many, many people, George Packer, all these kinds of figures, became cheerleaders for the war. And they don't know anything about the Middle East, but it doesn't matter. They know what's good for their career. Careerism is the primary disease at a place like the New York Times. There's nothing written on the wall that you have to, you can't say this or you can't say that, but you intuit. You understand very quickly the kinds of things that will advance your career in terms of what you report on and how you report it, and the kinds of things that won't. And I would cite the coverage of the student protests across the country against the genocide in Gaza. It was appalling. I mean, they painted these students, and I spent time at the encampment in Columbia and Princeton. I mean, these students were not anti-Semitic. Fairly significant percentage of them were Jewish. You would have these very moving moments on Friday nights where they would have Muslim prayers, and then on the same tarp, they would have Shabbat. But the New York Times, I think, was guilty essentially by seeking out Zionist students and mischaracterizing the movement. I mean, the coverage was appalling. But that caters to the establishment. The reporters who go are sent up there. They know what the editors want. They don't want to be a management headache. I think it's Cold War liberalism, and then it's a pretty knee-jerk response in terms of its support of Israel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to write any kind of, you know, fact-based narrative out of the West Bank or Gaza. I speak as someone who did it for 7 years. It was a constant battle.
I'm sure. So this aspect of careerism that you're describing, I think, is often a very understated factor in why corporate media is so often homogenized, doesn't question anything. It's not a very sexy complaint. It's much kind of more passion-provoking to say, they're right-wing, or they're on the left, or they're pro-war, or whatever. But this careerism aspect, though maybe a little more banal, I think is so crucial. And I have to say, even though I've known this for a long time, the one time I really saw it most vividly is when I began very aggressively and vocally dissenting on the Russiagate narrative, both because I thought it was journalistically baseless, but also because I thought it was so dangerous to play this game of creating this kind of sinister ethos around any communications with Russia. And I would hear from all the time people inside large media corporations, not entry-level journalists, but sort of mid-career, writing to me and saying, I'm so glad you're expressing these doubts. And of course, the subtext was, I can't. And part of me would always say, why can't you? Why don't you? But I know why. It's because the minute they stick their head up with a kind of consolidated media, layoffs, and they're one day yelled at by liberal Twitter or the establishment media of Twitter, they're put first on the list of layoffs and last on the list to hire. It's just very easy to get rid of them for that reason alone. So for me, knowing all this about corporate media, I've always had kind of one foot for a long time in corporate media. Now I'm very much independent media. I always felt like I was a very big booster of independent media. This idea that, independent media is sort of the solution because with technology, it gives a lot of other voices the ability to have a show like this, where ordinarily you would have to have a major television network or a printing press to reach a lot of people. The internet lets you increasingly with a lot of ease reach people in similar ways to the corporate media, not necessarily the same extent, but in a very influential way. You have, once you left the New York Times, thrived in independent media. And I think there, as enthusiastic as I am, there are still some flaws in it. I know you recently had a situation with your own work, and I want to get to that in a second. But generally speaking, have you seen independent media, meaning journalists and people who work without corporate support and therefore without corporate constraints, as a very promising alternative to or weapon against corporate media? And is that something that you still believe?
I think, you know, there's always been alternative media. We used to have, and I write for Bob Scheer's website, SheerPost. He used to be the editor of Ramparts. So the role of alternative media is that it always shamed the traditional press into doing their job. That's what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did, which is why after they had to run his stuff, they turned on him to destroy him, especially The Guardian, Bill Keller at The New York Times, all these kind of figures. If they didn't print the Iraqi war logs, they would have been exposed for who they are. But immediately, once that they did publish that material, they were part of that massive effort to the character assassination against Julian, the demonization of Julian. So it's that's a good example of the role of the alternative media. For instance, Ramparts published that iconic photo of the little girl running down the road in Vietnam who was being burned by napalm. That was Ramparts. COINTELPRO, that all came out in the alternative. Cy Hirsch, My Lai. So the role that you play, Matt Taibbi, others play, is that they do real journalism. You have this dynamic where the traditional or the commercial press, which posits itself as objective and fair and unbiased and all this kind of stuff, on the one hand, they have to respond to alternative media, and on the other hand, they loathe it because it exposes much of their moral bankruptcy. I think that has always been true, going back to Ida B. Wells, the great journalist, had a newspaper in Memphis till the mob burned it down. But she exposed the reality of lynching, which was not that black men were preying on white women. Of course, the irony is that rape was the national sport of white men in the South. Mary Chestnut writes about going to plantations and seeing two dozen mulatto children, which then their biological father would sell. And she exposed that it was the black bourgeoisie, it was the doctors, the businessmen, those were the ones that the white business class saw as a threat and were, they were the ones who were largely lynched. And And so it's always been those gadflies that have essentially created some kind of pressure on the mainstream media. And that's what I think we're part of a very long and honored tradition. I.F. Stone, who ran I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. I know that's what you tried to do with The Intercept until it got hijacked. It was, you had a wonderful quote. I knew those three people who were running The Intercept, and I saw a quote or something, tweet or something that I read that said they all wanted to be invited to the dinners at the New York Times and the New Yorker. And that is exactly it. And I know them as you know them. And that's about the disease of careerism.
Absolutely.
Because institutions like the New York Times are powerful. They're powerful.
Yeah, and they're prestigious, and they open doors that otherwise aren't open to you, and for people who crave that being let in. And I know it can be intoxicating. You know, when the Snowden story happened, there was an attempt to kind of demonize me, but then once we sort of won and won all these awards, it was kind of like, okay, come in and we'll give you all these rewards. And it can be tempting. You have to very vigilantly guard against it, almost reject it aggressively, or it can commandeer you in ways that I saw. So I understand why that's enticing for people. I guess the question, though, is, and you're absolutely right, there's this long tradition, even going back to, like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive era, a lot of those were just like muckraking journalists who were putting pressure on big corporations and monopolies, exposing all kinds of fraud and the like, political fraud. But I guess the idea that I have, and maybe it's just we always think whatever is more recent is more impactful, but the technology, I think, now allows these alternative media to be not just on the outside with a small audience able to influence and invade the discourse periodically. But, you know, you look at some of these independent platforms on YouTube, on Substack, on Rumble, on anywhere, and a lot of them have very large audiences that compete with and sometimes even exceed, say, cable programs in prime time that are backed by major corporations. And I guess for me, I think what always happens is when there's some new kind of counterforce in the incipient stages, people get very excited by it, glamorize it. It's just sort of this revolutionary force. And then it has growing pains and it starts to have its own kind of problems. And for me, the two threats I see to independent media are, number one, the increasing ability to censor the internet, to kind of suppress alternative ideas on the grounds that they're disinformation or hate speech. And number two, the sort of self-imposed censorship that a lot of independent media outlets impose on themselves out of fear that they're going to be stigmatized, the kind of desire to remain, you know, within whatever circles they're in. And I know you had a recent incident where you were working with Real Clear Network, which is
Real News Network.
Yeah, exactly. Which is an independent media platform. And you basically, they separated from you and you wrote a long article about why you think that was. So talk a little bit about that and how that relates to these broader themes of the challenges that independent media might face.
Let me first just go back historically, because on the eve of World War I, we had powerful socialist movements in this country, including powerful media organizations like Appeal to Reason and the Masses. And when Wilson brought us into the war in 1917, when we saw the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, they turned on those. I think Appeal to Reason was the fourth largest circulation in the country. I think the Masses was also very big. You saw very similar phenomena where they shut them down. I mean, they literally shut them down. And you're seeing that kind of pressure now through algorithms, through deplatforming. So this does again replicate a certain historical period. In terms of the power of the alternative media, I think you're right, and I think this is also something that you and Matt and others have pointed out, is that it also works in tandem with a loss of credibility by the traditional media. The traditional media's MSNBC, CNN, all these shows have completely lost their credibility, and that has created more pressure on alternative media as well. So yes, the technology is different, but the phenomena is much the same, and the engine, or the animosity that is directed against us, just doesn't come from the state or the intelligence agencies or corporations, but also from that traditional media, which sees us as a threat, and we are a threat.